All right. Well, everyone, let's go ahead and get started today. This is Understanding Your Congregation's Unique Worship Culture. I'm Monique Ingalls. I'm Assistant Professor of Church Music at Baylor, and I'm trained as an ethnomusicologist, which is a discipline that uses kind of a combination of methods from the social sciences like anthropology and musicology to understand music in context. I think that a lot of, and I'm going to make the case today, that a lot of the insights that have come from this discipline and from this way of studying music are applicable to worship more generally. So that's why this isn't just about music. I'm not calling this, understanding your congregation's music culture, but worship culture more broadly. So I think we know, and each of us are from many different places, churches with vastly different histories, geographical and social locations, demographic makeups, and I think that we, one thing, important thing to remember when we come to conferences like this and are exposed to a lot of ideas, is that there's no one-size-fits-all approach. In fact, trying to, take an approach out of the box oftentimes backfires terribly, and the solution to, trying different boxes and trying everything on to see what works, wearing yourself out doing that, is cultivating a deep understanding of your worship culture so that, you can mix and match and select from the ideas that you see and hear in spaces like this. So, we all have eyes and ears. We all see and hear what goes on every Sunday morning, every Wednesday night, during rehearsal and through the week. But we all have blind spots. And sometimes we see, but we aren't quite sure how to interpret what we see. Or sometimes we'll see things and we interpret them through familiar narratives, and we may not be getting to the heart of what's actually going on. So it's some of the obstacles to, I think, this deep understanding of our own worship culture. One of them can be, especially if you're moving into a new context. I don't know if anyone here is in the midst of transition to a different church or to a different ministry within a church, can be distance. You don't know what's going on because you aren't familiar with it. You don't know the people. It can be difficult. Where do I start in trying to understand some of the dynamics? But proximity as well, not being able to see the forest for the trees, is equally an equally bad problem to have to deal with. And one I think that most of us that have been in our particular positions for a period of time of years or more fall into this particular problem. Sometimes we lack tools to produce new insights. So, how do we get beyond our limited perspective or our perspectives that it's at too great a distance? Lack of frameworks to interpret things differently. I think that's why we all come to conferences like this, is to kind of get a different set of lenses to be able to look at our own contexts. And then related to this, unexamined inferences. I think not sure if I have that, that slide. I'm not sure if any of you have seen this. I ran across this in a book some years ago. It was developed by an organizational psychologist. And I think it, particularly, I don't think that this necessarily, works across cultural contexts sometimes, but at we here in North America, in Northern and Western Europe as well, this is how we experience the way that we move from the things that we feel and sense and touch and things, and then the way our beliefs influence our actions. And so, just to give an example of moving up the ladder of inference, this has I've spoken to people that this has happened to more than once. You observe external data and occurrences. So say you're a worship leader, you want to, you're trying to find ways to reach out across generations. You have youth in your church, you have young families, you have older adults. So you decide to observe the youth one Sunday morning. Next comes selecting, filtering, etc. You can't watch all the youth, all the time. So you focus, for some reason, your eyes are drawn to one particular young woman who's sitting, kind of in the the middle right or so. As the opening hymn, you know, blares out from the pipe organ, from the worship band, whatever else, it's a hymn. You watch the young woman; her lips aren't moving. She's standing there. You know, I'm not sure if you can see her eyes, kind of what if she's focusing on anything else. And so you make, going up the ladder of inference, making assumptions on things that you think you know and meanings that you added in. Some people, you know, may be tempted to say, ah, she's not singing because she doesn't like that hymn or because that doesn't, you know, minister to her in some way. You draw conclusions. You know, you can see that in some ways, like a slippery slope would be almost a better illustration than climbing a ladder. You draw conclusions from that. You know, the youth just don't appreciate our hymn heritage, you know, and so on. And your beliefs about the world are influenced. And that goes back around again and may affect what you see. When you look at, you know, a youth next time, you may be prone to impute that belief that you got. You know, we don't know. Going from the second to the third rung, all we know is that she's not singing. We don't know why she's not singing. Maybe she doesn't know that particular song. You know, she doesn't read music, and so it's difficult for her to learn. Maybe it's a less accessible hymn. Maybe she's having, you know, a really terrible week, a terrible semester, and wouldn't sing anything if it were happening. So this workshop is to give you some tools, perhaps, to break out of the ladder of inference, especially spending time on this second step. This isn't meant to help in evaluation, and I'm going to have us do an exercise a little bit later. And I'd ask you to, I know it's hard, you know, for us, we sometimes want to skip ahead and rush to judgment. You know, is this good or bad, appropriate, not appropriate, useful, you know, or not useful in our context? I'd like to keep us kind of centered today on this, on the level of, you know, of observing, seeing, hearing, trying to broaden our perspective kind of without moving up the ladder any further. So the goals for our short time together today, I want to give you some tools for understanding your worship culture and some techniques for becoming a better observer and listener. And towards the end, or probably the second half of our workshop today, we'll do something interactive. I've got a framework for you to apply that I think hopefully will be useful for you in your particular context. So one way of moving past, let me go back to these obstacles to understanding. One way of moving past these issues of distance and proximity is to use a set of methods culled from, again, social science methods, one known as ethnography. Ethnography, this slide was developed by, is a research method that uses firsthand experience to obtain knowledge about a group of people. Oftentimes, especially in the early history of anthropology, ethnomusicology, sociology, some of the academic fields that use this approach, it was often North American and European researchers going to other parts of the world. And so they had the overwhelming problem of distance, of how do I even make sense of what's going on? All of these customs, these beliefs, these values are very foreign to me. So ethnography was a method that was developed to try to create proximity where there was distance. However, I think ethnographic tools, interestingly enough, can also be used to create distance where there's close proximity. And so using some of the tools of ethnography, especially in recent years, there have been more and more ethnographers that, unlike Greg Bars here, who is not an insider, who's an American, who writes about music in East Africa. There are many groups of people who are studying their own cultural groups. I study North American evangelical Christianity, having been brought up as one and still, you know, remaining in those circles. So the goal of an ethnography is to address or explain a particular issue. You'll also hear it called ethnographic field research or ethnographic field work. And it's really a set of different methods. The most important one is being there in person. And certainly all of us as worship leaders, as musicians, as pastors, on a week-to-week basis, you know, we all fit that particular requirement for ethnographic methods. Some of the others that I'll hit on a bit today, interviewing, surveys. Observation, talk a little bit about the difference between what I'm calling free and structured observation. We'll do an exercise in structured observation towards the end. Participation, that's one thing, especially to create proximity. Ethnomusicologists oftentimes learn the instruments or music of the people they study, and again, generally not a problem for anyone here. And then documentation, things that you can refer back to later that can aid your interpretation. So I want to talk about just a few of these, give you some tips for possibly using these in your context. The first one, which you know might be, actually before I get that up there, the first one which you may find a little odd to think about is interviewing. An interview sounds like something that a journalist, that doesn't know anything about a situation would go in, to and do. But interviewing can actually be very effective, even with people that you know. How is an interview helpful? I mean, one of the things that it does, again, it helps to create distance. An interview is different from a conversation in this way. It creates distance and it's goal-driven. The best interviews may feel like a conversation, and it certainly takes practice with the format before things start feeling a bit more organic. But with interviewing, it provides focus. It provides a focused space where you could get the same perspective, from a particular person, probably over a series of weeks or months. Sometimes an interview can help you sort of shortcut that. It can also spur further conversation and more in-depth conversation later on, once you've gotten a set of questions kind of out of the way. It often yields surprising perspectives. I can probably count on one hand the number of interviews that I've had that I was, able to predict all the way down the line kind of what a person would think. There's always something surprising that comes out of, asking someone a set group of questions about worship. And it also feels less disingenuous, perhaps, if you have three or four particular questions that you're trying to kind of worm into conversations, that can sometimes feel awkward. So just being clear about your motives and setting aside a frame of time, saying to someone on your team or in your congregation, your perspective is valuable, and I'd like to try. I have some questions that I'm asking, a group of people, a sample, and I'd like you to be part of that. Do you have an hour to have coffee and have and discuss some of these questions that I have for you. So a few tips for if you choose to use interviewing as a method to understand your worship culture. Again, the goal is to understand the other person's point of view. That's one of the things that's different, interviews and conversations. Conversations, you're injecting more of yourself and, of your understandings. And certainly, feel free to do that. If your interviewee, asks, what's your point of view? There's no need to be, artificially try to be unbiased in that way. But understanding the other person's point of view is paramount. State your explicit purpose, at the very beginning, kind of set this this time, frame it as something different from an ordinary conversation. Repeat and restate active listening. There are, of course, many books on that. A lot of seminaries incorporate active listening. We won't go into that. These are, in some ways kind of obvious. It's good to express interest in what the person has to say, but also expressing ignorance, not starting out, on the third or fourth rung of that ladder of inference and assuming that you mean, that you know what a person means by a certain word that they use, by a certain story that they tell. Encourage them to expand on their responses so that you do understand. And then using hypotheticals, that's another of these interview tips. One thing that I'd recommend to you, if you want to go into this in more detail, it's quite technical, but also very comprehensive. James Spradley's The Ethnographic Interview. I have, for anybody that's interested later on, I'm not sure I've got enough of these for everybody here, but please come up afterwards. It's a forming and asking interviews, different kinds of questions that you can use. And I've adapted the format specifically for worship. So actually, more copies of this were made. I'd forgotten about that. So I think I probably do have enough for everybody. If I've got enough of those for everyone, I have enough of these. So thank you. So this is just for your reference later on. We won't go into any more detail on that right now. So That's interviewing. Surveys. Surveys are another form of ways to understand your worship culture by trying to gather together as many perspectives as possible. I'm curious as to how many of you, just show of hands, how many of you have designed a survey for use in your congregation, in your church? Got one, two, three, four. Yeah, so a few people have. That's excellent. The thing about surveys, I've seen, every time a worship leader friend talks about designing a survey, I have them just like, oh, could I see it? You know, because I'd like to both, you know, glean good ideas for later on, and also, you know, sometimes I've offered to help a few people tweak questions. The ideal survey, according to the Harvard Program on Survey Research, these are three, you know, nice short statement, three things to keep in mind. It accomplishes three goals. Measures the underlying concept that it's intended to tap. It doesn't measure other concepts, and it means the same thing to all respondents. And this particular, that means the same thing, using language that everyone is going to agree on. You know, this is in a survey, for instance, you know, it's not a question you might want to avoid going kind of on from a conversation a couple of days ago. You know, do you prefer traditional worship or contemporary worship? You know, those two particular terms can mean, you know, have this a variety of meanings across contexts. So avoid terms like that unless there's some very specific meaning to your congregation, unless you have in some way say define those terms for yourselves, which I don't think any congregation to this point has. The survey design tips, some things to keep in mind here. Keep it short, less than 15 minutes. One mistake a lot of people would make, they get really excited about mining these perspectives. And really, if it's going to take more than 15 minutes, do a set of interviews. Interview a sample of your congregation instead. Because one of the things that happens, if it's going to take people forever, a worship leader once sent me a sent me an interview with 18 open-ended questions, a survey, and I thought, oh goodness, you know, you're going to get, you know, some people may respond. It's people, you know, you're going to get people who have a lot to say on that topic already, and a lot of time, obviously, to answer 18 open-ended questions. Make sure to keep it short. Sometimes we're not good judges as to how much time something is going to take, especially when we've designed it ourselves and, you know, have responses on the top of our head. So test it on some of your colleagues, family, or friends first. Consider question order, because what you ask first often influences the way that people are thinking about the topic. So that's something that oftentimes I have suggested tweaks with students and with colleagues. You know, maybe you might want to save that question till last, especially if it's of a sensitive nature, if it's going to you know, kind of provoke memories of a controversy or of something that's going on right now. Ask it at the end, and just in general, go from easy to hard, and generally, usually from general to specific, unless there's a good reason to throw in something specific, maybe as a follow-up to a general question. And this is obvious as well, avoid leading questions, charged language, vague terms. Sometimes we don't always know what these are. I mean, we can obviously identify obvious leading questions, you know, like, do you think the music minister should select fewer old irrelevant hymns? I think we can all avoid doing things like that. There may be some questions that we don't perceive, and this is why making this as much of a communal endeavor as you can is a good idea. So avoid leading questions, charged language, vague terms, etc. If you choose to do surveys to understand your worship culture. So I'd like to spend the rest of the time talking about observation, and when we observe cultures, going back to that ladder of inference, this was true of researchers, and I think is also true of the way that that popular culture books encourage us to see culture. We have certain beliefs about what culture is, what culture involves, and the old view that a lot of people had, and I like to say draw a little illustration of this. The old view of culture, or a culture, so defined as, on multiple levels, we're looking at kind of the micro level of an individual congregation. Certainly this was applied to whole groups of people, whole societies. The old view of culture is that it was, people viewed it as fairly static, you know, that it was unchanging through time. There was an emphasis on the preservation of tradition. This is also when the notion of culture sort of grew up in opposition to quote unquote civilization, which was something that North Americans and Europeans thought that we had, other people had culture. It took, thankfully, we began to realize, oh goodness, you know, everyone has these patterns of belief and value and practice. And so we have to remember the inherent, some of the inherent bias here. But we viewed culture as relatively unchanging, as homogenous, you know, so all of these same units. So think of, kind of an old school anthropology textbook, X group of people, you know, this is the way they think, this is the way they organize their society, this is how their political system works, etc. They emphasized these shared aspects, that they viewed culture as being built on consensus. And when you go in expecting something to look this way, imagine that. A lot of academic works and a lot of popular works today still make cultures, make from churches to the level of entire societies, look something like this. Think one of the things that ethnography has helped us do is to get away from this static model and to look at, you know, yes, a culture, a given group of people has boundaries, but those boundaries are constantly shifting. They're being negotiated. People fight over, you know, who's in, who's out. There may be, instead of multiple different cultures that don't overlap, we may have situations like this. And all of the people within a given culture, quote unquote. Instead of homogeneity, you have a great deal of variety. One of the things that that researchers found, you know, with this model, interestingly enough, white male North American researchers who went into contexts in, say, South Asia or Central Africa and things, they found that when they went back through their notes, they may have only talked to the men. So they were ignoring, you know, an entire, you know, the half of the society that was there, painting over, saying this group of people believes this way when they haven't talked to half of the people in there. So there are a number of different elements, different variables, race, gender, ethnicity, class, socioeconomic class, region, etc., that cause differentiation among members of a culture. And then, one of the new views too is that that oftentimes this difference creates tension. And I don't want to imply that all of this tension is necessarily bad, that we're all, you know, moving in lockstep, you know, towards that this is somehow, the homogeneity is an ideal. Sometimes tension is a problem. Sometimes dissent is a problem. But there is, in any culture, this element of tension, certainly caused by influences inside and outside as well. So with these as our assumptions, we need a better model, I think, of culture than some of the models that are certainly, that are useful up to a point. So a lot of models from cross-cultural communication, you've probably seen these in various books, you know, these spectrum graphs, you know, where does your particular society or group, you know, fall when it comes to universalism or particularism, you know, are you neutral, are you effective, et cetera. You know, these are helpful, I think, in much the same way that a tourist phrase book, you know, for visiting a country where you don't speak the language is helpful. I mean, this is helpful for getting a very broad and general sense of difference. But when you're working in a context and you're seeking a deep understanding of the dynamics that are going on, sometimes this can be of more limited use. It can stereotype and force superficial kind of ascriptions instead of getting to the heart of what's going on. So we need a model that is of culture that's dynamic when we observe. So, and that's where structured observation comes in. We'll get to our exercise with our diagnostic framework in a minute. I want to step back, though, and tell you a little bit about free observation. This is something that we all do. So sometimes, you know, when you sit back during worship, you jot down what happens. Usually, you know, we jot down what stands out to us, you know, and we're conditioned, once again, going back to that ladder, sometimes the things that stand out to us are... the things that we select or filter are conditioned by particular beliefs and assumptions that we have that we may not know that we have. So that can be useful up to a point. And I think that one way to make free observation more effective and actually and kind of fun too is to role play. Put yourself in the shoes of some other person, a person from a different subject position from your own. So if you're going back to that example from earlier, you're a worship leader, you're trying to make an intergenerational service, and you're in your 60s, you know, pretend that you are a teenager or a 20-something. Try to get inside their head. You know, it helps certainly if you have relationships with teens and 20-somethings. You can kind of hone your role-playing abilities by speaking with them. Also, vice versa. You know, if you're a 30-something, a 40-something, and are interested in, you know, how do you think this song would smack you if you were in a different age demographic? Role-playing can be a fun way to spice up free observation. Again, useful up to a point. I think where its usefulness ends, we can pick up with structured observation. And this is where you use a framework that is from a particular book, a seminar. I'm going to give you one that is adapted from an ethnomusicological model that will apply here and now, so hopefully you can get a sense of how it might be useful for you. So this is called from Jeff Todd Titan, his model of a music culture. It's kind of an introductory work that has been that he developed from many years of being an ethnomusicologist and now teaches to students. I think that the model works for, even though it was developed for music, it works well for really any kind of social performance, which I mean in the broad sense of the word. So including worship in there. I'm going to explain the model, and then we'll have some interactive time of applying it. So the components of a worship culture, drawing from Titan's model of a music culture, we have four domains that we're going to be looking at, four domains that each interlace and influence one another. It's a very dynamic model, one of the reasons I think that it's very useful. First, we have ideas about worship, beliefs. This includes beliefs, aesthetics, contexts, and histories. By context, I don't mean the space. That would kind of fall under material culture of worship, but the context, like what is the cultural, ethnic, age demographic, these kinds of contexts that are mainly ideological. The social organization of worship. What kinds of, this is where spatial organization can come in, the roles that people play, how leadership works, who is allowed to lead, who is not, etc. Repertories used in worship, and he subdivides this into quite a few different things, styles, genres, texts, and then the various processes. But basically what repertory is about is the content. So where does the content of your worship come from? What characterizes it? How is it transmitted? And then finally, the material culture of worship. What physical stuff is involved? And in particular, material culture of worship, there's been a lot of attention, certainly a lot of ink spilled about this, electronic media, you know, as influencing many of these other things. In closing, thank you for taking part and for your insightful observations. I hope that this series of diagnostic questions will be helpful for you as you seek to, again, kind of create that distance from your own context and understand how the things are interrelated. So why use structured observation? I think it, again, can give you sort of neutral language that's not charged, you know, that says, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong, you know, with style characteristics, with bodily movements, with material culture, etc. If we're talking about sometimes charged situations, it can enable you to imagine other possibilities. You know, once you think, oh, okay, well, well, our church, you know, uses, you know, our worship team dresses this way. What would happen if, you know, envisioning the implications of any change that you're considering? How would this affect some of the other domains? And then it can point out, as we can see, discrepancies or contradictions that need to be dealt with, or tensions that, you know, are just inherent to the situation that that are productive and that you'll, you know, that you'll need to to live with. So that need to be dealt with or not. So hope this is helpful to you. If anybody missed one of the handouts, please come up. Thank you so much for coming, and enjoy the rest of your conference day.